From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We feel great about tonight, not only in winning here in Indiana and accumulating some more delegates, but also gaining the momentum we need to take us to the finish line.
That was Democratic presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders Tuesday night after winning the Indiana primary.
We started this campaign way, way, way behind. Nobody, I think, would have dreamed that here at this particular point in May of 2016, not only would we be here, but we would be winning elections, but we are. So I sense a great deal of momentum. I sense some great victories coming. And I think that according to every poll that I have seen in the last month, Bernie Sanders defeats Donald Trump in the national polls by greater margins than does Hillary Clinton. And Bernie Sanders beats Donald Trump by greater margins than Hillary Clinton in battleground state after battleground state after battleground state. In other words, I think the objective evidence is that I am the strongest candidate to prevent Trump from becoming president.
For his part, the Republican frontrunner ran up another victory in a long string of wins over rivals Ted Cruz and John Kasich. Cruz, for his part, after beginning the day with a massive assault on Trump, calling him a pathological liar and worse across the media, ended up throwing in the towel when the day was over.
Together, we left it all on the field in Indiana. We gave it everything we've got. But the voters chose another path.
This has been an amazing evening. I didn't expect this. I didn't expect it. And just so you understand, Ted Cruz, I don't know if he likes me or if he doesn't like me, but he is one hell of a competitor. He is a tough, smart guy.
The presidential nomination process continues forward after yet another win for the two outsiders, Sanders and Trump. For more on that, we spoke with Dr. Richard Wolff, noted economist and political commentator, via Skype Tuesday.
I hope, honest enough to admit I didn't see either of these two people being able to do anything like what they've been able to do. I am very much persuaded that I am the typical person in America in this regard. Even though, of course, as this continues, more and more people need, for whatever reason, to proclaim that they always saw it coming or grasp altogether what it is. Let's start with Trump a little bit. Yes, he's brash. He's direct. He's undiplomatic. But to tell you the truth, I don't think there are all that many fundamental differences even in what he said, and I think even more likely there will be very few in what he tries to do and even fewer in what he gets done. So that this is, for me, mostly theater. And theater, but by the way, I'm very respectful of theater. Political theater is an important part of any society's politics, and if you don't remember that, you will not understand how all kinds of mysterious people who nobody thought were doing anything other than theater ended up in power. And I mean Adolf Hitler, and I mean Berlusconi in Italy, and in some ways Sarkozy in France. These were people who were political actors in the theatrical sense more than they ever were serious policy people. But they had the right theater at the right moment, and win, lose, or draw, their impact was enormous. So I think what Mr. Trump is doing is feeding on the accumulated frustration of the Republican base and feeding them the theatric that they much prefer. They don't want the namby-pamby middle that the Republican leadership has mostly been. They're much more excited and have been by anything that sounds a little more honest, a little more saying what they believe and know is not diplomatic to say. Half of what their interest in the Tea Party was exactly that. I think Trump figured that out the way many other Republicans did and said, look, if the Tea Party can push all the buttons on social policy, I can do them the same, and I can push it on all kinds of other issues like jobs, like foreign trade, like those untrustworthy allies of us that are always taking advantage of us. These are old Republican ideas, and I think he's just said, look, I'm going to tell it like it is, and the anger and the distance that the mass of Republicans have now found themselves from the professional politicians made this a very successful ploy. On the other side, with the Democrats, frankly, I also think it's largely a piece of theater. But like with Trump, this theater can become very serious depending on what he does, depending on whatever the outcome of the election is, what the Congress looks like, what the economic, particularly the economic problems of the United States become over the next 2 or 3 years, which, by the way, I think are very serious. But it could become something much more profound, something much more desperate, and something much more extreme in its next steps. So now for a minute with Sanders. Sanders is coming in and saying to the vast left of center part of the Democratic Party's traditional constituency, and even more the left that has left the Democratic Party in disgust, in frustration, even if they vote for them on election day, it's withholding their nose. And Mr. Sanders comes along and says, I am going to dare to tell it the way you folks would like to hear it. Nobody dares do that. The Clintons never did it. They're certainly not going to do it. I'm going to do it. And you're going to be able to send a message about how angry you have come to feel about what the Democratic Party mostly isn't doing by voting for me. And to his amazement, I know enough people working with him to be quite sure of this, to his amazement, as much as anybody else's, certainly mine, this constituency is very large, very intense, and excited very, very much by this opportunity to make a statement of sorts by supporting him and making life very difficult for the conventional center of the Democratic Party. The big questions for me will be, how does this, what is at this point still very symbolic political theater, how does it manage to become more than that? And I think that's the big problem, really, for both of them, once this next few months is over.
You know, as Marxists, we're trained to look at objective conditions and also to provide a class perspective on these things. And you're looking at the assault that the working class has suffered for decades, the pauperization of and descent into or below the working class of much of the so-called middle class, no prospects, all of the things that Sanders and Trump, you know, will lay out, the debt on student loans, all of this stuff, the lack of jobs, the lack of opportunity for jobs, the trade agreements, all these things. Common problem recognized by and driving large parts of the movements, to use those words, below Sanders and Trump. With the division that has changed somewhat, but has its origin in the history of the break of whites from the Democratic Party in 1964 and 1980, and their identification with the Republican Party over the issue of race rather than their identification with other workers on the basis of their class. This is, though, in flux right now in a way that hasn't been for a very long time. You see the changed ideological perspective of many Republicans that voted for 30 years over abortion and gay rights and race. Now looking at Trump saying, we don't care where he stands on abortion, where he stands on any of this other stuff, he's going to get me a job. And a lot of folks looking at Sanders saying, we don't care if he calls himself a socialist, he's going to get me a job. How do you go from this fragmented sort of two masses of working class people with some serious ideological issues between them to some kind of class unity that can raise some class-based demands?
Well, I think you put your finger on it in the opening part of what you just said. The economic issues, I'm going to overstate the point, but to get at the nub of it, the economic issues after World War II were for a time held in abeyance, not for everybody, not everywhere, but in a general way, the United States came out of World War II having a new deal that really helped the mass of people to suffer a lot less in the Depression than they might otherwise. The war put everybody back to work, and the overwhelming Keynesian economics commitment of the 1950s, 60s, and into the 70s made it a time of rapid economic growth, low unemployment. It made it possible, thanks to the uprising of the CIO and the Socialist and Communist parties, without which there would have been no New Deal, but it made it possible for the defenders of capitalism in the United States to start telling these fantastic stories about a people's capitalism, about how we were all in the middle class, about how America was this exceptional place where everybody would have a job and everybody's income would go up a few percent each year and everybody would send their kid to college and so on and so on and so on. And there was enough to it that it could function as a kind of reason not to put economic issues forward in the way that had been the case both before the Great Depression and during it. When you add to that the sudden shift in politics, where instead of being the ally of the Soviet Union against Russia and against Germany and Japan, that Russia became the evil demon empire that was our arch enemy, you had yet another reason, the whole anti-communist push to squash the very coalition that had created the New Deal. When you put together economic well-being and a violent anti-socialist, anti-communist purge, well, then you had two very powerful pressures to make the middle of politics kind of the only place to play, the only place that the media would not either ignore or demonize. And I think all of that's gone. Basically, the Cold War is over. The big bugaboo of the Soviet Union is at best a memory that they can't quite shake at the editorial page of the New York Times, but in general, it's gone, number one. Number two, the wonderfully successful capitalism turned out to be not so wonderful, not so successful, rather like the old capitalism, an institution that is highly unstable, bounces around like a rubber ball, and all the while producing ever greater extremes of inequality. And I think what you have is the economic issue comes roaring back because the two things that held it in abeyance, prosperity in the post-war period and anti-communist witch hunting, are both, for different reasons, off the political map. And roaring back comes what was always there, which is these very different notions. If I could, though, Don, let me be, and I don't mean to rain on anyone's parade, but let me be blunt as an economist. Neither Mr. Trump to this point, nor Mr. Sanders to this point, and you can imagine where my preferences lie without my having to tell you, neither of them have come up with anything remotely like a credible program. I don't mean all the details. That's not required, and that's not fair to ask of them. But I mean a general definition of what it is they're going to do that has a ghost of a chance to actually address problems like either no jobs or poorly paid jobs or insecure jobs or failure of the American dream to be within reach. All of those things, I must tell you, I keep waiting, but I don't see it. And I suspect, therefore, that for the moment, and maybe that's the way political campaigns in this country have always been, we really have a lot of theater, but we don't have a whole hell of a lot of substance.
Right. I mean, if you're looking at realistically attempting to restart, I mean, just using their own terms, but looking to restart the economy in the United States, you would obviously have to stimulate employment. Essentially, I don't know how else they could do it, but then just have the state, the government hire people and put them to work. There are plenty of tasks to be done that are actually of intrinsic economic necessity, rebuilding bridges and roads and infrastructure all over the place, water. And also, I don't know how doing it this time, as opposed to, say, the 30s, 40s, and 50s, you would thread that through the financial structures, which are in a state of intense crisis. But if imagining that you could do that, you have to ask, where's the money coming from?
Exactly.
Trump has alluded to the fact that we're wasting all this money on the military, and even a few weeks ago, he's backpedaled from it last week, was talking about not spending the $1 trillion on nuclear weapons. There's a lot of money for jobs there. Neither of them are really talking about even the outlines of a program, as you stated. What would the outlines be?
Well, I think even before we get to the what the outline would be, you do have to, if you're in the position of a Trump as a kind of outlying political actor, and Sanders, you have to at some point confront what it is you can reasonably be expected to do if you win. Put aside for the moment winning. Let's assume Trump is president, or let's assume Sanders is president. How are they going to deal with the fact, as both of them know and as the citizens know, that they're going to have a Congress that is heavily divided and that the majority of people on both sides of the aisle don't like them, right, don't want to cooperate with them, yeah, are probably afraid of being embraced by them, and are being pressured by all the interests they're responsible to do none of what they're saying. I mean, the defense industries with their controls of the Republican and Democratic parties, they're not going to allow him to dismantle the nuclear defense, to reduce the wild spending of the Congress on defense, which, by the way, is every year greater than what the military themselves asked for. It's a kind of a grotesquerie that's replayed every year. They're not going to permit that. Likewise, as you rightly point out, if Sanders really means it, if he's going to formally move in the direction of a government employment program to rebuild our infrastructure or to do any of the other wonderful things he's rightly pointed out need to be done, he's going to have to tax. And who's he going to have to tax? The rich, which is what his hero Roosevelt did in good part in the 1930s. And how is he going to pull that off? Roosevelt had a coalition from below. Bernie Sanders doesn't have one. Is Bernie Sanders going to go over the heads of the Congress and appeal to the mass of people? If he is, we're in for a very rough ride, and he hasn't said anything like that, or even hinted that he could or would try to do such a thing. And in the absence of any of this, it's hard to take him seriously. And so even though the people have other reasons for doing this, you've noticed in the dealing with Sanders a kind of dismissal of the silly old man who's a nice guy and who wants everything in the candy store for all of us, but we don't have to think very much about it because it's a fantasy and we all know none of that is going to happen. He's not going to be elected. And if he were elected, none of that was going to. This kind of, this is very serious stuff because it bespeaks a kind of general feeling, both in the public as a whole and in the people who decide what these candidates say, that you're in a fantasy theater land where you can say kind of anything because no one takes it all that seriously. It's, again, the theater. It's thumbing your nose at the establishment, which both of them do in their different ways. And that's what people are excited about. And that's what they're focused on. And the rest of it doesn't really matter. One last way to get at it. I'm amazed at the number of people I speak to. Educated, uneducated, rich, poor, white, black, who basically, after a short conversation about the election, look at me and say, what difference does it make? And when you push it, they say to you, I voted one way this time, one way the next time. I understand on some peripheral issues there's a difference, and I'll probably vote for that. But in terms of the basic structure of the society, it really doesn't matter. That's another way of them saying, I'm in this for the theater. I'm not in this for the substance, because I don't think this is about substance, and nothing they say would make me change my mind.
Now, those are most likely people who have been involved for years. I'm wondering, behind Sanders and Trump, if we don't have people that are looking at this new. I know that Sanders, for example, does very well among millennials. Those are people who are participating for the first time, and they seem to be breaking down in almost every category in a way that's divergent from the rest of the population. Is there some potential there, and is it something that's of immediate of enough immediateness that it could end up being expressed through this election cycle?
I doubt that it will get very far this election cycle. I think you're absolutely right. The voting patterns of young people are stunning in their lopsided preference for Sanders over Clinton, at least on the Democratic side. It is, I mean, many states you have 80% in terms of voting of young people preferring Sanders. This is, of course, dynamite. If I were the middle of the Democratic Party, I am not, but if I were, that would be by far the most dangerous sign of what is going on. It means that for those young people, there is a risk for the establishment that their conclusion is not that what they did around Sanders was a waste of time, but rather that what they did around Sanders was a mere beginning, and they're now going to have to go back to the drawing boards, et cetera, and come up with a different candidate, a different set of proposals, a commitment to organization of the sort that Sanders did not have. They're going to have to explain what happened. Given that in their circles of young people, and I can see it in my classes when I teach, it's almost as if there's nothing but Bernie Sanders. The people who aren't Bernie Sanders, they don't say much because they don't want to be so different. They don't want to be the odd man or woman out in the classroom. Everybody is excited because it's possible to be excited about Sanders in a way that none of the other candidates even come close to for young people. So everything for me depends on what, I guess, three things. How those young people interpret what happens between now and the election in November. Number two, what actions the Sanders people will take in the direction of genuinely building an ongoing independent political operation. And that's a more important question than whether they would do that inside the Democratic Party, outside the Democratic Party, maybe even both. All of those are models and possibilities. And third, and probably the most important, is what is the political and economic reality within which young people are going to be making their interpretations of the Sanders campaign. And the Sanders people are going to face the realities of whatever commitment to independent organization building they're actually going to make.
And finally, on that note, the objective conditions that are driving what we're looking at now most likely will continue to deteriorate absent some major sea change in the direction of economic policy, which does not seem to be in the cards the way the electoral thing's working out. In a deteriorating situation, what should these folks be doing?
Well, let me tell you a story, Don. I met yesterday with a person who works for a hedge fund. I've known him a long time. He is a very sober, level-headed person, not given to strong points of view one way or the other. But he said to me over coffee yesterday that his advice to his clients and to me as his friend was to sell, sell, sell. And what he means is that over the next 3 to 12 months, he expects one or more serious downdrafts. These are his words, and they're the words that come from the business community. And for the reason you point to, that everywhere he looks, barring some wonderful, unexpected boost somewhere, hard to see but always possible, that the signs are everywhere of trouble. A slowing economy in China, a very lackluster economic growth. My God, in the first quarter of 2016, the other day, the government reports 0.5% GDP growth. Well, if you know how shaky those numbers are and how complex it all is with the estimates, that could have just as likely be a downturn or stagnation as anything else. And it's quite possible, this fellow said to me, that we're in for a bout of stagflation, of rising prices with all this money floating around, but no increase in production, because businesses are simply not going to invest money to expand capacity when they don't believe they can sell what they're producing now, let alone a larger quantity. Europe is in terrible trouble. The Asia, Africa, Latin America, because of China, because of Europe, is in trouble. And there is no way on earth, with the global economy as interconnected as it is today, for the United States to escape all of that. We've been saying that for a year. The last couple of quarters are a screaming demonstration of how and why that works. So I think we're in for trouble, and there's no reason I can see why that trouble wouldn't continue what is already a trend. You know, the Europeans blew up with general strikes, with industry strikes, with shifting governments to the left. I mean, socialists now rule Greece. Socialists and communists and Greens are the coalition ruling Portugal. The Socialist Party, while busy destroying itself, is still in charge in France. Socialists are part of the government in Germany. Mr. Cameron's in trouble in England and will be in the next election at risk of being defeated by the British equivalent of Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn, and so on. You've got signs everywhere, unless you are blind, that we're in for a lot of trouble. At first, it was Europe. In 2011, Occupy Wall Street brought home to America that it was here, too. It could take a little longer here. That's because of our anti-communist and anti-socialist history. And you could crush it, which the government did early in 2012. But because the conditions worsened, it all came roaring back in Bernie Sanders and the support for him and the enthusiasm and the intensity and the ratcheted up numbers. And I don't see any reason why, even if the worst were to happen to the Sanders effort, the continuing deterioration is going to give not just the right, but also the left, new energy, new troops, new enthusiasms, and I would guess even more pressure to come up with real, tangible breakthrough programs of the sort that weren't the strength of Occupy, were a little better with Bernie, but not that much, and I think will appear now to people to be an important part of whatever the next upsurge is against the capitalist system that cannot deliver the goods to the mass of people anymore. And everybody is slowly figuring that out.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.